morning, everybody. Well, I'm sure you've already done one panel and you've had your breakfasts and you've recovered from last night. And oh dear, Martin Edwards won the quiz.
Yes.
But now we're going to look at history. An affair to remember, a walk through history. This affair thing has been going around in the back of my mind. I'm thinking, how do we get an affair in here? But let's look at the panel. Starting right at my left, we have Carola Dunn. Carola, you are the author of the charming and immensely popular Daisy Dalrymple series, which is set in the 20s. Now, I've just heard that your degree was in French and Russians, and you started out writing Regencies. So where did Daisy come from, set in the 20s?
Well, when I started writing mysteries, which I really did because the two publishers I was writing Regencies for both stopped publishing Regencies, I didn't want to write mysteries set in the same period because I thought people will see the Regency on the cover and they'll think it's a romance and they'll be looking for something that's not there. So I went in search of a different period, and I'm not a historian. To tell you the truth, and this may be the first time I've admitted this in public, but I failed history in school. The only thing I failed, well, besides physics. So I'm not a historian, so I didn't want to go back into a period when it would be really difficult to find information I could understand, basically, and that I was able to find. So I decided to move forward in history. And the 20s seemed to me to have certain parallels to the Regency period. Part of it was the clothes. Because the Regencies, in Regency times, women's clothes suddenly loosened up. Instead of wearing huge hoops and tight corsets and all the rest of it, they became very much simpler. The Empire line, fashion from France, of course, where they didn't dare wear fancy clothes. And there's an absolutely charming picture from the period of two young women playing badminton, and they're actually able to reach over their heads, which in Georgian garb they couldn't even lift their arms to do something like that. And, you know, they had those wide skirts where you have to turn sideways to get through the door and so on. So that was one parallel with the 20s, where women went back in Victorian times, of course, to bustles and corsets and hoops and all the rest of that stuff, but and then in Edwardian times it was even worse, where they were forced into corsets that made them, it was called the Grecian bend, which turned you into a sort of S shape, out in front and out behind. And then partly because of the influence of the First World War, again women's clothes loosened up and you get the again, the sports clothes, the clothes where women could actually move physically, the influence of Coco Chanel and all that. And the other parallel was with travelling, because Georgian roads in England were truly appalling. Not only footpads and highwaymen, but potholes you could lose a carriage in. And carriages didn't have springs, so by Regency times, the springs had been invented, roads were gradually being improved, and women were much more easily able to travel. In fact, there's a fascinating diary, the diary of Miss Wheaton, who was a governess, and she used to go on these jaunts all over the country. She'd take a seat on the roof of the stagecoach, where it was cheaper, and she went off. She was a Northwesterner. She went off to Wales and to London for her little holidays all by herself. And then, of course, transport improved, there were trains and so on. But by the 20s, a young woman who had the money could go out and buy a car and take herself wherever she wanted. So there was, again, the sudden increase in freedom.
And so that's where Daisy came from.
So that's
an increase in freedom.
Yes, Yes, right. And the way the world was changing so fast, which it right. also did in Regency times.
Fascinating. Next is Shona McLean. Now, Shona is you are a historian, aren't you? You are in fact Dr. Shona.
Yes, I was a historian. I did.
Does anyone ever stop being a historian?
I don't get paid for it now.
Ah,
selling your books, you do.
Well, yeah, I was academically, yes, I was an academic historian, and now my history is all in my writing. I still do historical research, but it's all for fiction now.
And do you find your training as an historian a help or hindrance when writing of the past?
I find it a help, and I think my editor finds it a hindrance.
Because you've written three books now, haven't you, on
yes.
Alexander Seton, the first one of which was shortlisted for the Ellis Peters, The Redemption of Alexander Seton.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, that really came out of my academic research. I was doing a piece of work, I can't even remember what the piece of work was now, but I was working in Aberdeen City Archives, which has fantastic records in the vernacular, which... You know, my Latin is very rusty. When I was doing my academic research, I could make my way through a Latin document, but for Scotland from about the mid-16th century, you increasingly get records in the vernacular, which is wonderful because you can actually hear the voices of the man and woman in the street in the records. There are a lot of court records, church court records, and things like that. So although I was doing research into universities and finance, in the course of my reading you're coming across all these human stories all the time, and I found that's what was interesting me, and I had to keep sort of railroading myself back onto the serious stuff I was supposed to be working on, but all the time I was thinking, I wonder what happened to him, I wonder what happened to her, and it just niggled away. And there was a request at one point from a poor scholar for a bursary, and he happened to come from a place called Cruden. We were living in Cruden Bay at the time, this small town north of Aberdeen, and that's why he stuck in my head. And as time went on, and because of my husband's work, we moved further and further away from the university. I couldn't do my academic work, and I had several children at home to look after, but this poor scholar stayed in my head and started to develop his story. Every so often he'd be like banging at the back of my head, and this is what happens next. And eventually I started making his story up, and it's a wonderful freedom to be able to make it up rather than to have to prove in footnotes all the time, this happened and this happened and things. But as I say, I think my editor, she can spot when I'm going off on one, something that really interests me, but is of no interest, is really going to be of no interest to a reader. You know, it's just one of
the
my...
The byways stuff. Of history.
Yeah. Yeah.
Next, we've got Stephen Saylor. Like Carola, he's multifaceted, written monumental novels spanning the history of Rome and others covering Texas, but you've also written a crime novel set in Texas.
Yes.
in the 19th century?
Yes, but mainly my love is ancient Rome.
Right.
I have
because you've got this wonderful Roma Sub Rosa series of detective novels which are set in ancient Rome, and you bring in a lot of the actual history of the times, don't you?
Well, I was thinking when you posed the question, where do these heroes come from and the fascination for the history comes from, I think anyone who writes historical novels, there are so many layers within your own consciousness of what you're really calling up. It's not just the actual history you've learned and studied. For me, it does go back, for example, to Texas, even when I'm writing about Rome, because I was born in the year 1956. I think that's the year that Ben-Hur swept the world and won 11 Oscars. And created this, spawned all these movies coming out of Cinecittà in Italy and also Hollywood all over the world about the ancient world. So I grew up as a small boy watching movies about Spartacus and, of course, Ben-Hur and the Steve Reeves Hercules movies, Jason and the Argonauts, just everything spanning the ancient world. So that was this fascination from childhood, even growing up. I remember having a battery-operated Roman galley as a boy, about that long. It was a beautiful thing. It would go across the
You
floor.
Couldn't find any slaves,
you
huh?
Well, you did have slaves on the Roman galley, little plastic men and soldiers. And that was the sweet part of the nostalgia. But there's also some bitter moments and some sort of trauma. In the United States, we had something called a drive-in movie theater. You may have seen them in you've heard of them. If you've
I have been to one.
Because we didn't like to leave our automobiles. So you would actually drive into the theater and watch. And Cleopatra with Elizabeth Taylor, the late Elizabeth Taylor now, who died on my birthday, actually. I'll never forget that now. That film was such a worldwide phenomenon when I was a very small child. It just saturated the media at every possible level because of scandal and the expense of the movie and the grandeur of the movie, the excitement. So that by the time it reached my very tiny Texas town with a scratchy print a few years later, I was very primed to see it. But it was when films were becoming a little racy, and the projectionist, who was
Sorry,
the husband of a school teacher, felt he needed to censor the movie. Good in the small town, so that in the crucial scene where Elizabeth Taylor is lying naked in her opulent bath, being anointed, there's a small towel over her her buttocks. The camera begins to pan in, and somehow he hit a shuttle button or something in the projection booth, and it just zoom zoom zoom. And the scene was, and I think we were with Roddy McDowell as Octavian in the desert doing a scene. And I was very traumatized. I remember groaning to my brother, who said, oh, you really wanted to see that. I was probably 6 or 7 years old. But even at that age, it was not prurient interest. It was the historian in me wanted to see every instant of that movie, Cleopatra. So finally, many years later, we have the most complete possible prints out, which I have seen theatrically and on DVD. I've reached my closure with Cleopatra. But it did set me on a journey of being fascinated about the ancient world, just from childhood fantasy, so that I did study it at university. And the origin of my first novel was really after my first trip to Rome, which I didn't take until my late 20s. And that visceral experience of being in those ruins was just so electrifying to me that when I went back to San Francisco, I was reading a lot of crime fiction at the time, especially Conan Doyle, but a lot of crime fiction. I wanted to read, you know, sometimes you have this hunger for a book. You don't know what it is, you go in the store, where is this book I'm anxious to read? I wanted to read a crime novel set in ancient Rome. And believe it or not, in 1990, there was no such novel. We've had so many historical crime fiction since that time. And many times I think the first novel anyone writes is the novel they most want to read that no one else has written yet. You've got to write the novel yourself. So I found an oration of Cicero, one of his earliest trials, the trial that made him a star, actually a star lawyer, defending a man accused of murdering his father. The more he found out about the truth, the higher levels of power were implicated in the story. Reading that oration, I thought, I think this is that crime novel. It's just a true crime. So I managed to make a book out of that, created a sleuth to take the story forward. And lo and behold, I think the very first week I sent the manuscript off to an editor, I went in a U.S. bookstore, and there was this novel called Silver Pig by someone from England. I don't know. And I asked myself, is this a good thing or a bad thing? And of course, it was a good thing, of course. The more people read such a thing and want to read about Roman sleuths, the better it is. So I'm very honored to have been sort of across the Atlantic writing about an ancient Roman sleuth.
Well, we're delighted to have you here. And on my immediate left is Darren Lake, another prolific author with a string of historical novels, including an 18th century crime series featuring John Rawlings, an apothecary. Now, Darren, where did John Rawlings come from, and how many books are there now in the series?
I'll answer the first one first. I didn't find John Rawlings. John Rawlings found me. There was a firm called Canada Dry, who were drinks manufacturers, as you probably remember, and they'd inherited a label, Rawlings, and they knew nothing about it. They had some correspondence in their office which said, H.D. Rawlings, been established premises for over 100 years. So eventually they knew that Schweppes, who had also settled in England and were also making carbonated water, were about to challenge them as to who was the oldest, Rawlings or Schweppes. So they sent for me. I don't know why me. I think I must have known somebody in the firm. And they said, you will get £1,000 a week. And expenses, and you will find John Rawlings at the end of the fortnight. So I went to through all the archives, and eventually, it's a long, long story how I eventually tracked him down. But eventually, it was through the Worshipful Society of Apothecaries, and all their records and all their old things are kept in the vaults in the Guildhall in London. And I asked for a John Rawlings. I had to fill in a slip, John Rawlings, when he was made free, etc. And they went down and they came out with this book held like this and this magnificent white gloves. And I went through, and he was there all right, but he didn't give his address. And by this time, I was convinced that he was the man, that there was no address to link him to Nassau Street, which I thought was all imperative. So I left that. I went away a few more days. But I must just tell you one wonderful thing. I also looked at the notes of the Brewers Company. And for a minute, I turned over a page, and there was the signature, Richard Whittington. And my hand, that is Dick Whittington, for those of you who don't know. Dick Whittington and his cat was actually there. My hand laid itself upon his.
Was the paw mark there as well?
The paw mark was not there. I searched. I looked. No paw mark. Anyway, back to John Rawlings. I sent again for the same papers, as many papers as they could about him being made free of the society. And believe it or believe it not, the second lot of papers I looked at had number 2 Nassau Street on it, and I thought, this is it, and I'm afraid I shouted aloud in that place of great silence, got the bugger. Anyway, that's how I found John Rawlings.
But how did you then convert your factual John Rawlings into your fictional investigator?
Well, I put John Rawlings away on file. I had a big file on him, and I put him away, and I was writing very meaty historical novels with lots of bodices ripping and, oh, very, very exciting. And suddenly, one of them, which I thought was particularly good, didn't sell. And I wondered why. I really didn't know why. And then it was told to me that the historical novels market was dead. Nobody would buy anything that was a historical novel. And I was very, very concerned because this was, you know, my livelihood, and I was doing well and I didn't know what to do. But then I went to an old friend of mine called Dickie Douglas Boyd, and he'd been in publishing. In fact, somebody in this room might even remember him. He'd been in publishing with Michael Joseph, and I went to him and I said, what am I going to do? And he said, well, you must try detective. That's on the bubble, it's coming up. This, you know, the detective of the ancient world or any other world is coming up. So what I did was I thought, who could I have for my detective?
And there was John Rawlings.
And then I thought, it's there, it's in the files, it's all ready for me. So, in brief, I had him as a very strapping young apothecary who had just completed his indentures and was raring to go, and that's how we started.
Well, as you've seen, we've got we spread quite in fact a very, very wide area of time from the Roman classical period through 17th century Scotland, through 18th century England, up to the 1920s. And I'd like to ask the panel, do they think distance lends enchantment? I keep coming back to this romantic thing. Does distance lend enchantment when you're writing detective novels?
Definitely. A lot of people have a lot of troubles in the present, and they're up too close and they can't see them at a distance. And when you're thinking of the past, there may be all sorts of troubles, but they're not in your face. And it's maybe comforting to read about the troubles that aren't actually troubling you personally right now, this minute. I think distance lends enchantment.
What does anybody else think?
Well, not just enchantment, but it lends license.
Ah.
Because, I mean, I don't know if anyone here has watched, probably watched the HBO BBC Rome series, mm-hmm. but also the more recent Spartacus series. You really can't go much further with the license than that. You know, especially working in the ancient Roman world, I have the license to just do all kinds of licentious things that mm-hmm. would probably mm-hmm. be very outlandish and totally unacceptable in any modern idiom. So that we accept that I'm the only one here working in the pre-Christian world, and just the entire mindset of that pagan world is very different, and sort of frees up my own consciousness and my own imagination where to go with that.
I think distance does end, there is enchantment. But I like to bring into my book some of the stark reality. For example, a woman recently in one of my books has given birth to twins, and they were delivered by Dr. William Hunter, who was a well-known obstetrician at that time and was also a physician extraordinary to Queen Charlotte. And he just happened to be in Devon visiting, you know, his cousin, and he was called in, and he delivered the children beautifully by cesarean section. Oh yes, cesarean section has been there since...
It was very dodgy, wasn't it? Very risky.
It was not done by William Hunter. But yes, it could be, and it killed Jane Seymour, of course.
But Caesar was born by cesarean. I mean, that's why it's called
Sorry?
Caesarean. Caesar, Augustus, was born by cesarean section. That's why it's
yeah.
called cesarean.
Yes.
Sometimes you don't have alternatives, do you?
Well, yes.
No.
Well, actually, yeah, there were, but we weren't discussing
that. No. Stephen raised an interesting point when he said that he works in the pre-Christian era. What about morals? The way we look at moral questions does seem to vary according to the culture. I'd like to hear from the panelists how they find morals fit into their stories, and whether they find that they have difficulties with looking at the way their period looked at it. Shona, what about you? Because you deal. Alexander Seton is a failed clergyman, isn't he?
Yes. Yes, he aspired to the ministry, and as most of you will know, 17th century Scotland was a very, well, strict Calvinist society for the most part, and there were very high standards which people frequently fell short of. But I didn't really find it difficult to get into that morality. I mean, not on a personal level, I don't go about preaching at people, but... again, because there is so much available, so many records and diaries where people are agonising over whether or not they're of the elect, whether they are basically going to heaven or hell, you could see that it was something very real to people. So I don't find it difficult. I hope I don't find it difficult to write from a 17th century viewpoint rather than a 20th century. Mm. For instance, in the book that's coming out in August, it transpires that a couple of the characters are homosexual. Now, I would have said gay, but gay is not a 17th century expression. I'm not even sure homosexual was. I mean, there was nothing, you know.
You didn't mention it, let's face it.
Unmentionable, basically, or whatever, the way they would have spoken about it. while I, you know, there are characters in my books that I'm very fond of, but I can't have them being open in the way that we are open, because it wouldn't, you know, I can't give them the morals and the values that we have, because they simply wouldn't have had them. They might have had a sympathetic attitude towards friends, but they're unlikely to openly defend things that society as a whole was condemning. And, you know, I found it strange. I did a book group once, and a lady said, well, I found it very strange because I found the models were very, very open. They were very racy, and my mother wouldn't have done things like that. And, you know, in my first book, you know, somebody's being burned as a witch, people are being cast out for having illegitimate children. Yes, yes. Mm. So the models to me are not recognisable now, but for the 17th century they were.
Carola, you're almost in the 20s, more up to date than any of the others. What have you had difficulty or found it particularly interesting?
I found it interesting because I think the First World War made a huge difference to the way people looked at the world and the moral world, and the fact that such absolutely terrible things had happened and that men were slaughtered by the million. I think it drove a lot of people from their faith. They may have continued going to church, but perhaps they didn't really believe in a loving God anymore. And there certainly wasn't the same pressure as there was in Victorian times to conform. And in fact, one of my books, Sticks and Stones, that's STYX, deals with the case of a clergyman who was an army chaplain in France in the trenches and lost his faith and what came of that. Another interesting sidelight on those lines is the fact that Daisy and Alec, who Scotland Yard detective who becomes her husband in the ninth book, don't always have the same view of what justice is. Alec is a police officer and sworn to uphold the law, and Daisy doesn't think always that what the law would consider a suitable response would actually be justice. And she's more than capable of making her own decision not to report everything she's found out or guessed to Alec, because she doesn't think it would lead to a result that she personally approves of. And
so she has her own morals.
She has her own morals.
What about you, Stephen?
Working in the ancient Roman world, I almost feel like I have to tone down the material. Because of people who have read the Latin poetry of Catullus, for example, the amount of this scatological material and just the foulness of the language, which strikes us as so coarse, and yet this is sort of the most the highbrow literature that Rome has at the moment. The whole mindset is so very different that it's hard to penetrate. To some degree, that has been done for the general audience in those shows, Rome and Spartacus. There are certain lines said by John Hannah in Spartacus over and over, which are sort of so shocking to hear come out of his mouth. I don't really think I can repeat them here. I'll repeat them after the panel, but if you want to hear them said. But certain things he says, which are, they're just jaw-dropping. And I know John Hannah had the best time of his career playing that role, just cutting loose. And that has shown us one aspect of the Roman world that was not evident in those Christian stories like Ben-Hur, where they kept it all very polite, that the Romans did have this very raucous and sort of nasty tone to them. But those shows have made the mistake of leaving out the truly high literary fact that people like Caesar also wrote historical books, and they were scholars and jet-setters and literateurs. Sometimes I have to tone down the moral character of the people and what's going on, just the total freewheeling nature of it, because that becomes a whole other issue to try to ground the reader in this world. You also want them to be involved in the story. Sometimes I am asked if my hero, Gordianus, is not something of an anachronism, because he does seem to be a man with a moral bedrock, a recognizable character that people sympathize with. He does kind things, and his attitude towards slaves is, you know, he's a good man. He accepts the institution of slavery, but he doesn't like to exploit people. He's actually adopted a slave, this type of thing that he does. And people say, is he really just a 20th century man transported back to ancient Rome? But I don't really believe that. I think we also have a skewed view, because when we think of ancient Rome, we're looking through a prism of sources which tell us about really the most almost like sociopathic people on the planet. Cleopatra, Caesar, Pompey, all of those people are so power grabbing and amoral and grasping that I don't think they're representative of just the average population like you and me. I think you would recognize people like yourself if you went back to ancient Rome and have something in common with them. But something that this has been weighing on my mind ever since I started on this trip, because just before I headed here, I sent out an email announcement that I was coming to some of my readers in the UK, and I would be doing a few speaking engagements. And a reader wrote me back, and she said, I won't be able to make it to any of your engagements, but have a wonderful time on your trip. But also, when you get back, I'm going to send you a note about something in one of your recent novels. Well,
yeah.
I was like, don't leave me in suspense, lady. And so I emailed her back, and I said, thank you very much, but feel free to send me your feedback at any time. So she, I guess she didn't want it to weigh on me while we were traveling. So she sent me the email, and it was actually enormously touching, because at the end of one of my books, I wanted to sort of wrap up with, even though terrible things have happened, I wanted a very happy, whole ending of the book. And actually, Gordianus, who narrates the books, sort of one of the things he says to wrap up the book is, he says, in spite of all of these things and this chaos that's happened, after the Roman Civil War is happening, there's just been enormous dislocation and death and destruction, betrayal, chaos. But at the end of this book, he says, he sort of lists his family, and even though there's also been estrangement within the family, all of a sudden everything sort of has been made whole again. And we're all here and we're all together. I mean, obviously the world is a precarious place and terrible things are about to happen in the next book, but we're all here together. And sometimes when I get feedback, for all of us as writers, we get feedback from readers, things that are right in front of our nose that we don't see. This woman was concerned because within Gordianus' household, which includes a boy he adopted, who is a slave boy he adopted off the street, a barn boy, but who is an orphan whom he adopted, his own natural daughter, his concubine whom he freed and made his wife, I had left out the latest additions in the house, who are these two little slave boys named Mopsus and Androcles, and he sort of rescued them from a certain household, and they're kind of troublemakers. They're still young, they're rowdy and everything, and they're still slaves within the household. And I had left them out of this family list. And this woman, because of certain adoption issues within her own family, this was something that was weighing on her. And sometimes when you write these books, you don't really realize what the impact of any given element is going to be on any given writer. You can't really anticipate that. So I told her, I said, you know, I have made the occasional anachronistic mistake in my books, or especially within the family history over the 12 volumes, and because they've been in multiple printings, I've been able to go in to fix it. And I'm going to think about the next printing of that book. And the boys, Mopsa and Androcles, were also there. We were all there and we were together. So I'll bring the slave boys into the circle.
The people get really involved in your characters.
People can care about these characters, and you don't always understand, you know, for what reason or how it's touched someone.
Darren, you have this delightful character, John Rawlings. And one of the things that is both hampering and freeing, I think, when we write detective fiction set in the past, is the lack of technology. Now, your John Rawlings has a lot of information and experience in using herbs, poisons, and everything. How do you find that fits in?
Well, it fits in very well because he's slightly more knowledgeable than the man in the street because he's been studying herbs as a boy, you know, doing his, what do you call it? Oh, during his 15 minutes, during his apprenticeship. And so has quite an advanced knowledge. And I think when he sees a dead body, he looks at it in a way that the ordinary man in the street might not. And he might notice little things. For example, when a woman had been throttled with a pillow, he noticed a little feather. And he immediately thought there's someone had put a pillow over her face. But one thing I find that I do rather anachronistically with him is I find the swearing of the 18th century rather off-putting. I think like Gadzooks and Gadzooks and Zunes, that's the one I was going to go, Zunes, Gadzooks, etc., etc. Not really, don't quite fit in with his character. So he does tend to say, oh my God, more frequently perhaps than a man of that period would, because I feel that's right for him. So he's just got to be a little bit advanced about swearing. I haven't actually had many complaints about him, but I did have an email about the use of the water closet, which I've made quite a study of water closets and bog houses.
Carola, somewhere it's been said that those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. Do you feel that your books, to some extent, explain the past, or are they pure escapism?
They vary. They take place in, well, I've only got up to 1926 in 19 books, so... The First World War is not that far in the past, and most of the books have a character or two who was affected in some way by that. Well, Daisy herself lost her brother and her fiancé in the war, so you know it had a huge impact on society in Britain. The latest book, Anthem for Doomed Youth. It started really from the constant reports in the papers in America about men coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq with PTSD, if that's the right, post-traumatic stress disorder. And I was just thinking sort of in a vague way, yes, that's what was called shell shock in the First World War, and it's still going on. Nothing has changed, and perhaps we know how to treat it better now. But that linked up in my mind with the Wilfred Owen poem, Anthem for Doomed Youth, and that was really the genesis of the book, and everything that takes place in the book comes out of what had happened in the war. And I suppose it is a sort of cautionary tale in a way. We haven't learned anything. This was an apocalyptic event, and we're still producing them more for other people perhaps now than for ourselves. But
which leads me on to something else. Just before we open the debate up into the questions from the audience, I've got one last thing that I'd like to ask the panelists. Are you sometimes surprised by how history can confirm fiction? Shona, I think you've had an experience like this.
Yeah, it's just a little thing, but when I was writing my first book, one of the earliest things I decided upon was the name of my main character, Alexander Seton. I like the name, and Scottish Christian names in particular in the 17th century, there are about seven different Christian names for men, which can be a problem. It gets quite a bit. So I decided on Alexander Seton, and he was going to live in the town of Banff, where I was then living, and he was going to be a failed candidate for the ministry. And I was quite far on into my research for the book and the writing of the book when I discovered that the minister of Banff in 1626, when it was set, was called Alexander Seton, which was quite weird.
Has anybody else had that sort of experience?
No.
Produced something in writing and then found out it was true?
Oh, no. No, I like to research first,
yeah.
Then write. I don't write and then hope the research. No. That's not my style.
I think that speaking for myself, I think it's a dual process. Sometimes you don't know what you need to research until you have written, because if you just go on researching, you can go on and on and on and on and on and on. Whereas when you start writing, the writing goes in directions that perhaps you didn't expect. And I remember once for one of my Dorina Lyle books, I was writing about, I mean, this is not historical, though they are practically historical now, a vegetable merchant working out of Covent Garden who was selling produce to the main hotels and restaurants. And I had an introduction to one such at Covent Garden, and I went to have a chat with him. And after he'd shown me all around and everything, I said, could I ask him one or two questions? Because I wanted to know that I got the background to my character right. And he said, oh, yeah, carry on. So I said, well, you know, he started having a barrow, and then he built himself up to this great business like yours. And I've given him a Queen Anne house in Highgate, and he drives a Rolls Royce. And he looked at me and he said, you've been talking about me. And I said, no. He said, I started with a barrow, and as you've just seen, I have this great business. He said, I have a Queen Anne house in Highgate, and that's my Rolls Royce out there. How can you beat that? Well, perhaps we should open to questions from the audience. Yes.
Well, my next book in that series is actually going to be a prequel. Gordianus, who has aged a great deal through the years, faster than I have, actually, had a preview of getting into my 60s and 70s now. We've reached a critical time where we're on the verge of the assassination of Julius Caesar. And as one more holding mechanism, not to have to deal with that, because I don't know how to make a murder mystery out of that one. But I finally had a break in my schedule to do a book I've long wanted to do. And occasionally Gordianus has mentioned this in the stories, about when he was a young man and saw the seven wonders of the ancient world. And so I've had this break. I'm writing a series of short stories in which the young 18 and then 19-year-old Gordianus is going to go to each of the seven wonders of the ancient world, an itinerary ending in Alexandria, where his young life begins with his concubine. And they'll be published in various magazines and anthologies over the next year, and then there'll be a novel with an overarching story. So it's been a real delight in a couple of ways, because he's only 18, and I'm really having to think about the voice of an 18-year-old narrator. And I had to get serious about this because I mentioned it to a friend of mine, and I was saying, he's 18, he sees the seven wonders of the world. And my friend said, oh, and does he score at each of the 18? And I laughed. I thought, well, that's funny. And then I thought, oh, wait. He is 18 years old. When he gets into Ephesus, is he just dying to see the Temple of Artemis? Or might he be so close to Ephesus?
Stephen, we'll leave it there.
That's the next part.
Is the setting a character of the books? Who wants to take that one?
Well, I don't have any, like Stephen, my characters move around. I think all of us probably, we aren't stuck in a little St. Mary's Mead. But the settings are very important to my books, some more than than others, and some I've set in real places, and some I've imagined the place to fit the story, but they're definitely a character, and the story grows out of the setting as much as the setting is required by the story.
Another question? Yes?
What character, other than the main protagonist, are you most proud of having written about, and why? Who wants to take that?
Can I take this one?
Yes.
Oh, I will.
You can go on.
I have a character called Bailey Bichon in my first book, who is a very unbending Calvinist who's always checking up on people and everything. And he's actually one of my favourite characters, because by the end of the book you see why he is the way he is, and I find him very likeable, and my main protagonist understands him by the end as well. And I find it's a lot of fun to write about a character that on the face of it is unpleasant, but if you can get below that, it's quite satisfying. So I think it's probably him.
My favorite character that is beside the Rawlings books was Charles the Seventh of France. He had an obese mother who used to chew emeralds because she thought they would relieve her pain, whatever it was. She got so fat that she had to be wheeled on a small trolley where she was going. You may think this is fiction. This is fact, boy. She was wheeled on a small trolley to and fro. Her husband was mad, the Mad King of France, and thought he was encased in glass. So the children were kept to... Yes, this is true. So poor old Charles the Seventh of France didn't have much of a start. He had two elder brothers, two dauphins, who were going to inherit. And slowly but surely, they both died of syphilis. And then only he was left. And he fought his way to the throne with the help of, unbelievably, Joan of Arc. He was the prince that she went to see, and she was the one that helped him, and he managed to get back those provinces of France. And eventually, and this is just a lovely payoff line, he had fancied his son's girlfriend, who was called Agnès Sorel, and she was the most beautiful woman in France. So he nicked her from his own son, and the son, as some ball, slapped around the face, and the slap rang round Europe. I thought that was a wonderful line.
Wonderful payoff line. Yes, Anne. Which, if there was a different period of history you could write about, what would it be and why?
Well, I'm writing a second series set in the 60s, and some people don't consider that historical, but it's now, how long ago is it? A long time ago.
50 years.
I'd write about the 50s, because that's when my parents met, and they brought all their own history together, and they'd lived through the war and things like that, so I'd like to understand where they came from.
And I've been real lucky. Outside of the Gordiana series, I've gotten to write a couple of big novels about spanning a lot more of Roman history. Roma, from the founding of the city by Romulus and Remus up to the time of Caesar. And my newest book, Empire, which starts with Augustus and gets up to Hadrian. So I get to do that whole, all of those crazy emperors. And answering the question about characters we're happy to have done, I would love to getting to do my own Nero. That was such a treat to actually do my own take on Nero. Also Hadrian, which I think really needed a new take. And also Apollonius of Tyana. Does anybody in this room have ever heard of Apollonius of Tyana? He was one of the great holy men of the ancient world, sometimes thought of a rival of Christianity. I finally got to actually put Apollonius of Tyana in a novel and explain who he was.
You must not leave out that book of yours, Honor the Dead, which is set in Texas.
That's that Texas book that I... No,
yeah, but the way you handle it, I think, is brilliant. Absolutely stunning. And me, I would write in any period of history because I love them all. I think there's something exciting and wonderful about any period you like to look at.
Well, I'm sorry, it's time. Now, we do have a prize for the most interesting question. What has really fired all you? Was it the last one or the penultimate one?
I don't know.
About what characters or what times or periods or settings?
The characters one. I thought the characters, which is your favourite character.
The characters, yes. That was you. Yeah. Okay. Here we go. The question on, apart from your protagonist, which was the character you most like to read about, write about, and you to read about. Okay.